Bhadram karne vishnu yama devaha Bhadram pashyemakshabhir yajatraha Sthirai rangaihi stushtu vagam sastanubihi Vyashema devahitai yadayuhu Swasti nahindro vriddhashravaha Swasti nav pusha vishvavedaha Swasti nastharkshyo harishtanemihi Swasti no brahaspatirdadhatu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Very good. Welcome back. Yes. We've come to the end of our text, Amrita Bindu Upanishad, and with the end of the text, we're coming to the end of our series of talks that we started in fall, taking up these short Upanishads. So we'll conclude that tonight. Could we turn this up just a tiny bit? Thanks. And just a tiny bit more. Good. Then I don't have to. Good. Thank you. And here at the end of the text, we come to a section which I think you will find delightful. Some of our texts that we've studied have been pretty heavy. Ishavasya was a very heavy text. Mandukya Upanishad was a very heavy text. The content was very demanding. Some of it was obscure, a little difficult. Kaivalya, a little less so. This text, quite a bit less obscure, less challenging. And it happens to end in a particularly light or pleasant way. When I say light, I do not mean in a trivial way, because what's being taught is extremely profound. But profound teachings can be taught in a very delightful manner. And there's a nice metaphor. Do you remember? I don't think you remember. I don't remember when you were this big. And mommy or daddy would tell you a story, and they'd open up a book. And many times when we're quite young, like 2 years old, 3 years old, I don't remember being that old. But often, you know, they'll open up the book, and the book will be 90% pictures, right? Those books. 90% pictures, you know, big page, big picture, and just two lines of text on the bottom. That kind of book. And as children, I suppose we loved those books because we related so strongly to the pictures. Those pictures really stayed with us somehow. Those pictures went in, they stayed with us. Well, if you study the Vedas and if you study the Upanishads, there are no pictures. But there is the equivalent of pictures in all of those texts. The equivalent of pictures is what we call drishtanta. Drishtanta, in English, metaphor or analogy. A metaphor or analogy is like creating a comparison, and to me it's like it's the equivalent of a picture. It's instead of being very analytic and precise with language, it's using language to create a picture of something else that represents a particular Vedantic teaching. So we use drishtantas all the time, which every drishtanta paints a picture. A rope snake example. That's a very vivid picture. Every time we talk about a pot, that's a very vivid, tangible image, the image of a pot, the image of a picture. We've used imagery of like a movie screen, not very traditional imagery, but we've used it nonetheless. So these kinds of images, these drishtantas, are very powerful. They're also delightful. because they're easy to grasp, they paint a picture that really stays with us. They stays in our mind and heart, and they can help us so much. Some very complex principles can be taught very simply by means of a drishtanta. Look at the pot example we used in a prior class. The relationship between pot and the space that it contains. There are some very sophisticated concepts that can be explained in a simple way with this pot example. So we're going to see here at the end of the text, the next four verses have four drishtantas, four word pictures that we're going to see. Each one, it's not methodical in any way. There's no particular progression from one drishtanta to the other, but it's like four pictures at the end of the book. Every one of these word pictures have a very nice story to tell. The story, of course, is to summarize all the teachings that we've seen. Not just summarize. In fact, this verse doesn't summarize. It makes a very new point and a very interesting one. So let's begin. We'll see these four drishtantas in verses 18, 19, 20, and 21. And then there's just one verse after that to complete the text. Grantam abhyasya medhavi, grantam abhyasya medhavi, jnana vijnana tatparaha, jnana vijnana palalamiva dhanyarti, palalamiva dhanyarti, tyajet grantam asheshataha, tyajet grantam asheshataha, dhanyarti. There's a typo there. You can correct it in your text. All right. So when we take these drishtantas, it's helpful to start with the drishtanta, the metaphor, and then turn to the darshtanta, that which the metaphor represents. So here the drishtanta is found in the second line. Palalam Eva. And the word Eva is a good, those of you who know some Sanskrit, when you see Eva, you should think drishtanta. Eva, just like or as. Also, yata and tata. These are the other words that introduce drishtantas. Yata, just as, blah, 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 blah. Tata, in the same way, blah, blah. All right. Here, instead of yata, tata, we have Eva. Eva, just like dhanyarti, dhanya, grain. Arti, someone who wants. Dhanyarti is someone who wants grain. What should that person do? They should tyajet, get rid of something. What should they get rid of? Palalam, the husk. If you want grain, you know, if somebody gives you a handful of raw rice, you can't cook it. You have to get that husk off before it can be cooked, before it can be consumed. So just as the dhanyarti, one who wants grain, tyajet, should get rid of the palalam, the husk, eva, just like that. In the same way, go up to the top line now, medhavi, a wise person, medhavi, grantam abhyasya, abhyasya, having studied, grantam, books. Now, actually, it's singular book, but it means plural books, all of our scriptures. So medhavi, a wise person, grantam abhyasya, having studied the scriptures, someone who is jnana vijnana tat paraha, and this connects to dhanyarti, someone who wants dhanya, someone who wants grain. In the darshtanta, it connects to jnana vijnana tatparaha. Tatpara, one who is focused on, one who wants, one who is focused on what? Gaining jnana and vijnana. Jnana, spiritual wisdom, knowledge of your true nature, knowledge conveyed by Mahavakyas like Tat Tvamasi, Aham Brahmasmi. So someone who is jnana tatpara, focused on gaining that Vedantic wisdom conveyed in the Mahavakyas, not only jnanam, but but also vijnanam. In this context, we could translate vijnanam as enlightenment, liberation. So someone who is tatparaha, intent on gaining spiritual wisdom, jnanam, and vijnanam, liberation, what should that person do? Grantam abhyasya, having studied the books, well, what did the dhanyarthi do? If you want the rice, you have to get rid of the husk. And here, if you want true wisdom and enlightenment, what do you have to give up? Tyajet, you should get rid of grantam, the books, the scriptures, asheshataha, all of them. No, you don't leave any of them out. You throw away each and every one of those scriptures. Hey, what? Here is a scripture saying, after you're done studying this scripture, get rid of it. And this is not facetious. It's absolutely real. If you've understood the content, you must set the scripture down, because to focus on the scripture is to focus on the wrong thing. We've joked about this many times. We come to study Upanishad on Tuesday nights. On Saturday mornings, we're studying Bhagavad Gita. And you've heard me comment, if you come on Saturday morning to study Bhagavad Gita, you're wasting your time. Huh? If you come on Tuesday night to study Upanishad, you're wasting your time. How can we say that? What is the goal of our study? To master a scripture or to discover your true nature and gain enlightenment? Really speaking, the subject matter of study is your true nature being non-separate from Brahman. That's the subject matter being studied. So if we make the mistake that many people do, if we make the mistake of focusing on the scripture, we're really missing the point. You've heard me use a metaphor, to go from one metaphor to another, the metaphor of scripture like a road map. If the purpose of a road map is to lead you to a destination, when you get to the destination, you don't have to keep all the road maps. It served its purpose. But further, the danger. Well, I wonder if this happens. This is just an image comes. Suppose you take a trip. Suppose you've, nice metaphor. Suppose you've dreamed for years of a vacation in Paris. I don't know why Paris is such a big deal, but people say vacation in Paris. Okay, let it be. Or Venice. I don't know why these are big. Whatever the place is. So you've dreamt for years of a vacation in Paris or Venice. And of course, you have all the maps and guidebooks. Of course, you have to. And you finally get to Venice or Paris, and you sit in your hotel room reading the travel guides. People do that. You sit in your hotel room reading the travel guide and the maps. Instead of going out and enjoying it, you're stuck with the travel guide. The scriptures are like that travel guide. As long as you're stuck with a travel guide in your hotel room, you're not going to enjoy Paris or Venice at all, until you throw away the travel guide and get out. That's the metaphor here. As long as we are focused on a scripture, any scripture, if it's Veda, if it's Upanishad, if it's works of Adi Shankaracharya, if we're focused on the scripture, if we're holding on to the scripture, we're holding on to the wrong thing. And in fact, enlightenment will be delayed. As long as we're holding on to the scripture, enlightenment is delayed. As long as you're stuck in your hotel room reading the travel guide, your enjoyment of the place is deferred. Only when you set down the travel guide do you enjoy the place. Only when you set aside a scripture will you have the real opportunity to discover fully and completely and personally what the ancient rishis wanted you to discover. Isn't that a nice metaphor? That's the first of four So tyajet grantam asheshatara. Really, just a couple more comments before we continue. First of all, he makes it very clear, asheshataha, all of them. Sometimes, can't I just keep one or two? No, asheshataha, every last one of them. And notice, we saw in Bhagavad Gita, actually we haven't gotten there yet, I think it comes in chapter 4, but in Bhagavad Gita and certain other texts, you'll see a criticism of the karma kanda of the Veda. You'll see a criticism of portions of the text, you'll see a criticism of scriptures that are mostly about rituals. And you'll find, in fact, we saw in Ishavasya Upanishad here, we saw a criticism of Karmakanda, and basically the message was, get rid of those scriptures, that's all about ritual. Those scriptures dealing with ritual will not help you. But notice, in this particular passage, it's not the Karmakanda you're not being told to get rid of only those scriptures, those that deal with ritual, Karmakanda. Asheshataha means all scripture, including Upanishads, including this Amrita Bindu Upanishad, including Bhagavad Gita. Asheshataha, all scriptures are to be set aside. Why? Final, we'll go from one metaphor to one more metaphor, then we'll proceed. These scriptures, another way of understanding them is a container that holds something of value. Suppose you have, a cardboard box. This metaphor just comes. A box full of pasta. All right. So you have what you get at the supermarket. You get pasta often in a box. The box is a container. Are you fascinated by the pasta box? Can you imagine? Just really spent, and on the pasta box, all they'll write about the ingredients and cooking instructions. Suppose you focus on the pasta box, reading the instructions, admiring the design of the box, the color, the shape. Pretty silly, right? The box is a container. It's what's inside the box that is of value. And significantly, you throw that box away. You cook the pasta, you throw the box away. You can think of the scriptures as though a container for these spiritual teachings. The container is not what's important. The spiritual teachings are what's important. Okay, we'll go on to the next. That's first of our four metaphors. Now the second. So first we have rice, we have grain and husk. Now we have cows and milk in our next metaphor. Gavam aneka varnanam, gavam aneka varnanam, kshirasya pyeka varnata, kshirasya pyeka varnata, kshiravat pashyate jnanam, kshiravat pashyate jnanam, linginas tu gavam yata, linginas tu yam. Pashyate, there's a typo there, it should be the lingual sha, I'm sorry, the palatal sha, not the sha. Yata, there's one of our words that tell us we should be thinking about a metaphor, a drishtanta, yata, just as. Go back to the beginning. Gavam, for cows. Cows which are aneka varna. For cows, aneka varna nam. For cows of various colors, aneka varna. Cows have many colors. How many colors is the milk? So brown cows, milk. The black and white ones, totally black ones, totally white ones, any other colors. I don't know what other colors they come in. But whatever is the color of the cow, aneka varnanam gavam, for cows of various colors, kshirasya, for the milk they produce, there's eka varnata. There's only one color. One color, regardless of the coloration of the cow. Cows of various colors give milk of one color. So this is our drishtanta. Now we have the darshtanta below. Darshtanta is in two parts. First, what do the cows represent? And then what does the milk represent? First of all, what the milk represents, kshiravat pashyate jnanam. Pashyate jnanam, you should understand jnanam, knowledge, spiritual wisdom, as being kshiravat, as being like the milk. So think of knowledge as being like the milk, and linginaha tu gavam yata. And you should think of gavam like the cows. Linginaha is a little obscure word that's used here for scriptures. So let me explain in general, and then we'll go into a few details. So cows of many colors give one color of milk. Cows of many kinds, not just color. There are different shapes, different sizes, different breeds, I suppose. I don't know. I guess farmers know all about that. What do I know about cows? Anyway, to me, they're all cows, but to someone who breeds cows, they have all different breeds and names and all of this. But regardless of the breed or type or color of cow, they all create the same color milk. In the same way, the cows represent scriptures. There are all kinds of different scriptures. There are Vedas, Upanishads. We're talking before class of Ramayana, Mahabharata, Puranas, and then we have the scriptures of all of our great acharyas, the scriptures of Sri Shankaracharya, the scriptures of Ramanuja, the scriptures of Madhvacharya. We have just Jnana Sagara, they call it, an ocean of wisdom, an ocean of scriptural knowledge, innumerable scriptures. But look at the metaphor. Cows of any kind, of many kinds, yield one kind of milk, white. Same way, scriptures of many, many kinds yield one knowledge. Kshiravat pashyate jnanam. Knowledge is like the milk. So the scriptures of all of these different, all the different scriptures end up revealing one knowledge, one truth. If we're talking about the truth of who you are and the truth of the cosmos, this is a subject matter of Vedanta, are there multiple truths? Are there multiple truths for your true nature? Are there multiple truths for the truth of the universe? There's one truth, there's one reality, but that one truth or reality can be revealed in very different ways by a whole wide variety of scriptures. So we can say then that our vast array of scriptures, as different as they are, and cows can be so different in appearance, not just color, but their appearance and their breed, etc., just as cows can be remarkably different from one another, and yet they yield the same white milk, in the same way our scriptures might be remarkably different from each other, yet they yield the same truth, because there can be only one truth. There's only white milk, except the children who like chocolate milk. But I think we know by now that the chocolate milk doesn't come directly out of the cow. I wonder if children think brown cows must make chocolate milk, right? All right. So we know that milk means white, and there's only one kind of milk. In the same way, if we really get it, there is but one knowledge. that the ancient rishis gave us through these spiritual teachings. Here, you know, it's a little casual, I suppose, to put all of our scriptures into one basket. This verse does so. This verse really does put all of our scriptures into one basket, which is oversimplified. But then it is a picture, the kind of picture you'd find in a children's book presenting something in a very simplified way. So when we say all scriptures reveal the same knowledge, we put the word all in quotation marks, because definitely the Karmakanda of the Veda teaches something different than the Upanishads. Even among the Upanishads we find differences, and certainly among the teachings of Sri Shankaracharya, Ramanuja, Madhvacharya, we find differences, absolutely. So, or somebody might say, oh Swamiji, what about the Bible? What about the Quran? Those are scriptures, so they all teach the same truth. Again, all scriptures in quotation marks. So we would say, if we want to be a little more precise, we would say all the scriptures which convey the teachings of Advaita Vedanta, that's pretty precise. All the scriptures that convey the teachings of Advaita Vedanta, as different as those scriptures might be, and they are still different. There's tremendous difference from one Upanishad to another. There's tremendous difference from Upanishads to Bhagavad Gita, to works of Shankaracharya, to works of Shankaracharya's disciples. We can find tremendous differences. But among all of these Advaita Vedanta scriptures, to be more narrow, there is absolute unity in the one truth they reveal. Before we move on, let me just mention, some of you know, some of you may not know, that there's a text known as Brahma Sutra, a very important scholarly text. And the purpose of that scholarly text was to show that all of the different Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, that they all teach the same thing. To show that there is one tatpadya, one bottom line, one final truth, siddhanta, that's being taught through all of the various Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita. And this resolution, I guess, of any apparent differences between different texts, all of that gets resolved by this very scholarly text, the Brahma Sutra. So in that sense, all the Brahma Sutra then, in a scholarly way, establishes the unity of Siddhanta, the ultimate teaching of all of these texts. Utterly the same, absolutely the same, and it's established in a very rigorous way in the Brahma Sutra. Oh, what would you say if someone collects a huge herd of cows, different kinds of cows, and doesn't milk them? What's the point? What's the point of a huge herd of cows if you don't milk them? Do you see where this is going? Do you know people, who have a huge bookcase with all kinds of spiritual books on that bookcase? Many of them have never been opened and read, and certainly not read thoroughly. What's the point? The point of the cows is to get the milk. The point of all these various scriptures and texts is to get the milk of the scriptures. There's a verse about the Bhagavad Gita that's called Upanishad. Oh, the term doesn't come. Talking about milking the Upanishads. I have to get that verse. It's in the Gita Dhyanam. There we go. Yeah, good, thank you. So the Upanishads are like the cows. You milk the Upanishad cows to get the milk of spiritual wisdom, which is the Gita. The Gita, how's that for metaphor? The Gita is the spiritual milk of the Upanishads. Anyway, another metaphor. So to collect cows without milking them is just silliness. In the same way, to collect scriptures or books without really plunging deeply into them and really understanding what it is they want us to understand. It's just a waste of time. Okay. That's the second of our four metaphors. Now we come to so the first was rice and grain. The second was cows and milk. Now the third is butter or ghee and milk. And we got milk again. And this verse, oddly, this verse doesn't really follow a meter properly. It's kind of meterless. Gritamiva payasini gudham. Gritamiva payasini gudham. Bhute bhute vasati vijnanam. Bhute bhute vasati vijnanam. Satatam antayatavyam. Satatam antayatavyam. Manasa mantana bhutena. Manasa mantana bhutena. I wonder sometimes why, if when traditional meters are set aside, meter and chandas is in Sanskrit, when a poet chooses not to use a particular chandas or meter, I sometimes wonder why. But then, why am I so hung up on everything that should be in a proper meter? Why should I superimpose my expectations on this ancient rishi, that this ancient rishi should follow a meter? Why isn't he following a meter? Ancient rishis can do anything they want. Who am I to pass judgment? All right. And the reason I point that out is it's possible to convey this statement in proper meter. It's not that difficult to write, if you know Sanskrit well, it's not that terribly difficult to write Sanskrit following the rules of a particular meter. For whatever reason, and I have no idea why, but for whatever reason, this rishi has chosen not to do so. Okay, enough. So, what is our drishtanta here? Gritam eva. Eva is introducing our metaphor. Eva, just like gritam, ghee. Ghee is nigudham, hidden. Where is ghee hidden? Payasi, in the milk. Ghee is hidden in the milk. So the milk comes out of the cow. The ghee is present in the milk, but you don't see it. You can't taste it. It's there in the milk, but it remains to be taken out. So just as ghee, gritam, is nigudham, is hidden, payasi, in the milk, in the same way, bhute bhute, in every creature, vasati vijnanam, in every creature vasati dwells vijnanam. Here, excuse me, vijnanam means consciousness, chit, chaitanya. We have to interpret the word properly in every context. In this context, vijnanam means consciousness. So what is the first line telling us? The metaphor, just as ghee is hidden in milk, in the same way, consciousness is present in every being. That's literally what the line means. Bear in mind, if you have 1 liter of milk, do you have any ghee? In a manner of speaking, yes. You can't see it, you can't taste it, you can't do anything with it. It's present, but it's unrecognized. In fact, unrecognizable as long as it's mixed in with the milk. In the same way, watch this. When you see a conscious being, like the one who's sitting up here blabbering away tonight, when you see a conscious being, do you see any consciousness? Huh. You see the milk. You don't see any ghee in there. You know there's ghee in there, but you don't see it. When you look at a conscious being, you presume there's consciousness in here. You don't know for a fact. Long ago in a class, I suggested, how do you know that I'm not a cleverly constructed robot placed here by some UFO civilization and just a machine, just very well programmed? How do you know? You don't know. You presume that I am like you. Might be wrong presumption. You presume I am like you, and in particular, you presume that my thoughts are known due to consciousness in the same way that your thoughts are known due to consciousness. This is a presumption. You do not know it directly. You cannot perceive it. You cannot perceive consciousness any more than you can perceive ghee in the milk. Got it? Then we see the second line. So how will you separate the two? How will you separate the ghee from the milk? How will you separate consciousness from the body-mind-sense complex? This is what's taken up in the second line. So how to separate things? Satatam mantayatavyam. Mantayatavyam. You should churn. Satatam. Ceaselessly. You should continue churning and churning and churning and churning. So you churn the milk to separate the ghee. In the same way, there's a kind of churning that goes on here. Manasa, with your mind. Mantana Bhutena, with your mind, which takes the place of the mantana, the churning stick. Actually, churning, I don't know, what is it? Is it like this, or is it like this? Like this. All right. What do I know as much about churning as I know about cows. All right. So, with that stick, you churn the milk to separate out the ghee, which was always present, but indistinguishable. In the same way, manasa, with the mind, mantana bhutena, the mind which takes the role of the churning stick, with your mind, mantayatavyam, satatam, you should continually churn. Churning here means shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Or maybe nididhyasana we can leave out. Certainly shravana and manana, the process of Vedantic inquiry, shravana, and manana, dismissing any possible doubts, this is definitely an act of mental churning. And it is done. But look, I think the more interesting part of the metaphor is this. The ghee, which was already present in the milk, but indistinguishable. Let me back off just a moment. Does churning create ghee? Or actually, I should say butter, not ghee. Because the churning, you get the butter, and then the butter becomes ghee. The word ghritam, though, does actually mean ghee. But really speaking, the churning produces the butter later becomes ghee. So, when does churning create butter? Or does churning separate the butter from the milk? That's a very important distinction. The churning doesn't make butter, it separates the butter from the milk. The butter's or butter fat has always been there in the milk. That churning is not an act of creating something anew. It's an act of separation, a means for separating. For separating out something which has always been present. This is a metaphor. In the same way, the churning that we're doing right now, this manasa, this mental churning that goes on in this classroom, this mental churning does not create anything new. Cannot create anything new. need not create anything new, because the consciousness we seek is already present, present in its ordinary experience. What this mental churning does, however, is to create separation. Viveka is the word we use. Viveka, to distinguish, to discriminate one thing from another. In this case, to discriminate Atma, Anatma Viveka, to discriminate Atma, consciousness, self, from Anatma, that which is not self, to distinguish the presence of consciousness here amongst the body-mind-sense complex. So just as the butter is indistinguishable, mixed in the milk until we separate it out through churning, in the same way, consciousness is present in the body-mind-sense complex, and with this mental churning of Vedanta, we separate it out to appreciate it individually and uniquely. And this is the purpose of Vedanta. All right. So that's our third metaphor. So we went from the husk and rice to cows and milk and butter in this one, and now we go to the last of the four metaphors. The last of the four metaphors is a different kind of churning. This kind of churning to create fire, not butter, but fire. So to churn a stick to create fire. Let's see that last metaphor. We're back to Anishtubh Chandas, the normal meter here. Jnana netram samadaya, jnana netram samar, chodharet vanhivat param, chodharet vanhivat par, nishkalam nishchalam shantam, nishkalam nishchalam. Tad brahmahamiti smritam, tad brahmahamiti smritam. Jnana netram samadaya cha uddharet vanhivat param. So we start with the drishtanta. The drishtanta is vanhivat, just like fire. What about fire? Uddharet. You should raise fire. You should raise fire. Raise fire from what? You raise fire from wood. And the drishtanta, it's not laid out here in a great detail. You have to read a lot into it. Of course, if we lived 2,000, 3,000 years ago, we'd know all about this. Just like we know about cows and churning if we lived a couple hundred years ago. If we lived a couple thousand years ago, we would be experts in starting fire. And the usual way that it was done in ancient times in India is you'd have one stick of wood on the bottom with a little hole in it, indentation. There'd be some tinder that you'd put in that indentation. You'd have an upper piece of wood, which was fairly round, rounded, like a stick, rounded stick, which would sit in there. And then you would have a rope that you would use. Usually the rope would be on a bow. You would use that rope then to spin, to rotate. You could use your hand, but generally they would use a rope on a bow to spin that stick back and forth rapidly in that bottom stick, and the friction of the two pieces of wood is what would bring out the fire. Uddharet vanhivat. Just like you bring fire out of a stick of wood using a netra. Now there's actually a pun. You see the term jnana netra? In our last class we saw a pun. There's another pun here. Jnana netra has two meanings. Netra means eyes. Jnana netra, eye of wisdom. So jnana netra, using your eye of wisdom, samadaya, taking up, using your eye of wisdom. What should you do? Uddharet, you should raise up param, Brahman. Just like you bring fire out of the wood by this churning, in the same way, using jnana netram, the eyes of wisdom, you bring out Brahman, so to speak. There's several things we need to make clear here. It's a surprise for such a few words are used here, but the meaning is actually fairly complex. Part of the complexity is this pun on the word netra, because netra not only means eye, netra can also mean a string. And particularly, a string that's used for churning is another meaning for the word netra. This is why we need dictionaries. Without a dictionary, you may not know that. So, you consult a good dictionary or a good commentary, you'll find out that netra can also mean string. So now look at the term jnana netra. It doesn't only mean eye of wisdom, but it makes jnanam the netra. Jnanam is that which is used to cause the churning. Jnanam causes the churning. Jnana netra, the wisdom takes a is like the rope that causes the churning of the stick. The churning of the stick which brings fire out of wood. Now, there's another aspect of this metaphor. If you don't appreciate it, then the metaphor, this metaphor, I admit, is a little bit obscure. So this jnana netra part is a little obscure, that it's the wisdom that we receive from the Upanishad that allows us to uddharit, to bring out param, the reality, the truth of who you are, the truth of the universe. Now, there's another trick here. This idea of bringing fire out of the wood. In modern times, we know quite a bit about how fire starts due to friction and all of that, and the oxidization of the wood, the carbon being mixed with oxygen, all of this stuff. Scientifically, we understand that really well. In ancient times, what did they know about oxidization? Nothing. So, the way they understood kindling fire in ancient times is this. Fire is already present in the wood. This table is made of wood. So there must all, because this table is made of wood, fire is already inside this wood waiting to come out. Now, that's not our modern concept at all, but that's absolutely the way they understood in ancient times. Fire is already present in this wood. We have to coax the fire out. That's what the churning is about. The churning of the wood coaxes the already present fire to come out from the wood. Churning with knowledge coaxes the already present Brahman, ultimate reality, to come out from our experience, from our body, mind, sense complex, from our consciousness, from whatever is present right now. We coax Brahman out, just like coaxing fire out of the wood. The metaphor says we coax Brahman out of our experience through the churning with knowledge. This is a fourth of our metaphors. You can see that they're presented in a very non-systematic way. There's no transition from one to the other. It really is like four beautiful pictures at the end of a book. So the first picture says, don't hold on to the book. In fact, it says, throw the book away. Gain the knowledge that's inside through it, just like you throw the husk away, you throw the book away. The second metaphor said, of all of our scriptures, all scriptures give the same knowledge, just like different cows give the same milk, different scriptures give the same knowledge. Then the third of our metaphor is just like butter is hidden in the milk and has to be churned to separate butter and milk. In the same way, consciousness is present in every being, and we have to churn with our minds to separate consciousness from the body-mind-sense complex. And here we have the last of our four pictures or metaphors, just like churning with a rope, we bring fire out of the wood. In the same way here, churning with the rope of knowledge, we bring, so to speak, we bring Brahman out of this experience. The fire is already present in the wood. We coax it out. Brahman is already present here, and now we coax it out with the help of his teachings. That's the fourth of our metaphors. And that brings us to the end of the text. The end of the text concludes, it's traditional, that text will conclude with Pala Shruti, with a description of the benefits, the fruits of the scriptural study. So the second line of this verse, this begins to describe the fruits of this of study of this text, and then the next verse concludes the text with more elaborating on that. So, what is that param? What is it that we coax out? What is it that's the ultimate goal of churning through knowledge? That param is described here as nishkalam. It's a description of Brahman. That which is nishkalam, has no parts, nishchalam, unchanging, unmoving, shantam, utter peace. Another meaning of shantam would be silence, utter silence, shantam. And then it says very powerfully, tad brahma aham, tad brahma, that is Brahman. And tat brahma, that Brahman, aham, I am that Brahman. Iti smritam, thus it is understood. It is understood, tat brahma, aham, I am that Brahman. How powerful it is when a text ends by putting it in the first person. Just an observation here. Too often, we study Vedanta in the third person. Sorry to get grammatical on you, but there's a point here, an important point. Third person means talking about he, she, or it grammatically. Second person is you. Remember this stuff? First person is I and we. Too often, Vedanta is taught in the third person. There is something called Satchidananda Atma. It is present in all beings. Consciousness dwells in all beings. That's all in third person. Very different when a text says, hey, you are that consciousness. There's second person. But what's even more powerful is when you say, hey, I am that consciousness. Do you see there are three levels of remoteness here? Third person is most remote. Something called Satchidananda Atma is the truth of all beings. And that Satchidananda Atma is identical with Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. How philosophical can you be? It's all in a third person. Then we take one step towards you. You know that Satchidananda Atma we were just talking about? That happens to be the truth of who you are. That's a big improvement, right? It's a huge step away from philosophy and towards a personal realization of truth. Of course, when a teacher says, you are that, tat tvam asi, you are that, you may or may not get it. So the most powerful expression, if the third person is the least powerful, second person is a little bit better, the most powerful expression is in the first person, tad brahma aham, I am that Brahman. That's the ultimate expression of enlightenment. Iti smritam, thus it is understood. So this is the first part of the statement of the pala of the text, the fruits of the text, which will bring us to the final verse.
Sarva-bhūtādhi-vāsam-yat, bhūteshu-cava-satyapi, bhūteshu-cava-satyapi, sarvānugrāha-katvena, sarvānugrāha-katve, tadasmyaham vasudevah, tadasmyaham vasudevah. Sarva bhuta adhivasam. Adhivasam, the dwelling place
of sarva-bhuta, of all that exists, of all beings, that in which all beings dwell, yat, that in which all beings dwell, and bhuteshu cha vasati api, and api also, vasati, that which dwells, bhuteshu, in all beings. The first line, that in which all beings dwell, and that which dwells in all beings. We've seen expressions like this many times in many scriptures. That Brahman, in which all things have their existence, have their being, that Brahman, and that Brahman which vasati bhuteshu, that Brahman which dwells in all beings, that Brahman which is sarva anugrahakatvena, that being which is anugrahakatvena, that which causes blessings, that which brings blessings, sarva, for all, that which blesses everything, that which exists as a blessing, there's a best translation, that which exists as a blessing for all creatures, sarva anugrahakatvena, as a blessing for all creatures in a very fundamental sense. You are blessed with existence, physical existence. You are blessed with consciousness. Suppose you were not blessed with existence. You wouldn't be here to worry about it. Suppose you were not blessed with consciousness. You'd be like an inert rock. Again, rocks wouldn't worry about it. There'd be no problem. But how fundamental it is that we are blessed with existence, sat. We are blessed with consciousness, chit. And that sat, chit, is uncreated, boundaryless, limitless, infinite, ananda. This is the blessing, anugraha. The anugraha here is not like, hey, Bhagavan, please bless me with this or that. That's a very ordinary kind of anugraha, blessing. But here we're talking about blessing in a very fundamental sense. Brahman is that which blesses us with existence and consciousness, blesses every particle with existence and consciousness. When I say particle, even an atom is blessed with consciousness in the sense, consciousness as knowledge, as intelligence. That atom is intelligent enough to hold together. The electrons stay bound in orbit to the nucleus. There's intelligence in every atom. So every particle is blessed with existence and blessed with consciousness. This is the blessing of Brahman, satyam jnanam anantam brahma. That Brahman is satyam, the existence because of which everything appears. That Brahman is jnanam, the consciousness or intelligence because of which everything exists. And that Brahman is anantam, limitless, boundaryless, infinite. Sarva anugrahakatvena, that which blesses us with existence and consciousness, tad asmi aham, back to first person, aham asmi, I am, tat, I am that. I am that what? And the last word really sticks out. I am that Vasudevaha. What? Vasudeva Shri Krishna. Why is it? How are we suddenly talking about Lord Krishna? I thought we were talking about Brahman. Suddenly Vasudeva comes. Not only does it sound strange in context, but it sounds strange metrically. He violated a rule of meter by including the word Vasudeva. The word Vasudeva does not fit properly into the Anushtubh Chandas of this particular verse. So what would cause this rishi to set aside his knowledge of Vedic meters and cause him to introduce some very devotional aspect here at the end of the text. If you want to know why the Rishi did so, you'll have to ask him or her. But we might presume that this is a prayerful way for the Rishi to conclude his text, perhaps with a reference to his Ishta Devata, his chosen form. The fact that there's a reference to Sri Krishna also dates this Upanishad as being a later Upanishad and not a very early Upanishad, because the earliest Upanishads were probably recorded before the time of Sri Krishna's existence on his planet. So this Upanishad would historically date from a later time. You can see also how some of the ways in which we can get some dates for this. So perhaps it's a very prayerful way for him to conclude the text, I am that Brahman, I am that Vasudeva, I am non-separate from that Bhagavan Sri Krishna. And with this, the Rishi concludes the text. And since this concludes also our class, let me just end with a few concluding comments. So for this class, we chose to take these short Upanishads, Isha Upanishad, then Mandukya Upanishad, Kaivalya Upanishad, and concluding with this Amrita Bindu Upanishad. This gave us an opportunity to explore the teachings of Vedanta through the lens of the rishis themselves. And to me, this is a very challenging but wonderful and rewarding to go to the source text and to try and to use their very words to try to discover in person, personally discover what they discovered. I hope it's been a rewarding time for you. I have to say it's been very rewarding for me. I study all of, if you're here or not, I'm going to go on studying this because it's what I like to do. One of my students calls me a Vedanta geek. How's that? And it's correct. I admit I am a Vedanta geek. And what that means is I'm going to be studying this stuff whether you're here or not, whether Arsha Bodhi Center is here or not, because it's what I love to do. But I admit that to teach these texts enriches the experience tremendously for me. In two ways. When you teach something, you have to go into it much more deeply. If I'm studying it on my own, I may not spend as much time with it. I may not penetrate as deeply. But when you're sharing a text with others, then there's a lot of incentive, a lot of motivation to go very deeply into it. So that deepens my own study and makes it rich. Also, there's something that happens at the time of teaching. There's a little bit of a spontaneous process going on. You know, I don't really plan these classes. I look at the text before I come teach, obviously. And if there's a commentary I need to read, I'll do that preparation before a class. But you can tell from the teaching style that most of what comes out of my mouth is unscripted, unplanned, which means sometimes it's really silly and not very helpful. But sometimes I myself am surprised by a new connection or a new discovery that also takes place at the time of teaching. So in both of these ways, you give me a wonderful opportunity to deepen my own sadhana, my own study through this process of teaching. So I'm really happy we've had this opportunity to spend these months together. We will take a break over the summer months. Somehow to meet on a weekday evening in summer doesn't feel quite right, so we take a break each summer. We'll resume in mid-September. We'll announce the next text in our newsletter and all of that. Haven't quite decided. There are several options that we're considering, but we'll definitely continue this text in mid-September, and I'll certainly look forward to joining you again there. We'll conclude with our prayers.
Thank you, Swami.
Oh, you're welcome.